Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another scintillating episode of All Things Policy. My name is Sachin Kalbag. My guest today is my colleague, Professor Dr. Y. Nityanandanam, who is the head of Takshashila's geospatial program. He is an internationally recognized expert in geospatial tech. But for this episode, I have tapped him for a really important topic on which, again, he's an expert and he's done his PhD in the urban heat islanding effect, which has caused immense problems for urban agglomerations the world over. Now, why are we talking about this? Just to give you a little bit of context, in January this year, data from two leading global organizations told us, well, what we sort of already knew, that 2023 was the hottest year on record and 2024 could potentially be worse. America's National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, and Europe's Copernicus Climate Service simultaneously published data that should alarm the most hardline of global warming skeptics. 2 months later, World Meteorological Organization published in March this year its independent study that confirmed that NASA and Copernicus' conclusions were essentially right. NASA said that global temperatures last year were around 1.2 degrees Celsius above the average for the NASA's baseline period from 1951 to 1980. And Copernicus told us that 2023 marks for the first time on record that every day within a year has exceeded 1 degree Celsius above the 1850 to 1900 pre-industrial level temperatures. Now, close to 50% of the days were more than 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than the 1850 to 1900 levels. Now, in fact, in November 2023, there were 2 days for the first time were more than 2 degrees Celsius warmer. Now, the WMO report confirmed that the 2023 global average for near surface temperature at 1.45 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline. Now, in India, the Center for Science and Environment, which has been publishing the State of India's environment report annually since 2014, said in its 2024 report that India witnessed its warmest ever August and September in 122 years, as per the India Meteorological Department data. February 2023 was the warmest February on record since 1901. On September 12 last year, Srinagar recorded its second hottest day in 132 years in September. More than 3,200 people in India died directly as a result of heat waves, and around 2 million hectares of cropland was damaged. 2024 may not be so different given the heat that we are facing in the months of April and May already, and June and July could be even worse. Now, urban agglomerations are grappling with extreme heat, raising questions, according to Y. Nityanandanam, about whether these temperatures increases are due to local influences and global climate change. It is not a simple answer, he says, in his latest op-ed that he's written for the New Indian Express. But if we have to understand urban heat and mitigate its effects to a certain degree, then we ought to understand what really contributes to you and me sweating more. Well, our parents and grandparents were essentially right in cribbing about every year being hotter than the previous. Dr. Y. Nityanandanam, first of all, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sachin. It's my pleasure to be again on your show. And let's look for a wonderful episode this time.
Firstly, Nitya, what is the urban heat islanding effect? What is UHI? Could you explain to us in simple terms? And sure. How does it impact individuals like you and me, and of course, the society at large?
Great. So, the urban heat island is a phenomenon which generally says an urban area is slightly warmer than the rural area. When I say slightly warmer, it is recorded up to 2 to 5 degree variations on the temperature compared to the rural area, which means any urban area, any cities which are going to be hotter compared to its peripherals. The peripherals are generally the suburban areas, and then thereafter you have your rural areas. This is quite common for any cities. The cities are designed in this way the city centered in the middle and then surrounded by its peripherals. Now, Urban Heat Island, initially when people studied the city itself considered as an island, and all the villages around it are having slightly lower temperature. But then what happened these days, the city do have multiple islands within itself. So there are multiple pockets within the cities which are warm compared to the previous days. So which means there are a lot of anthropogenic activities happening on the ground, which triggers the local microclimatic condition alteration, which means whatever the situation on the ground as a city, now it has changed, it is more localized to different areas. So city as a whole also has an elevated temperature compared to the rural areas. So how does it mean to us? When you travel outskirts of your city, you can feel the temperature is slightly cooler. Whereas when you are in a city, you are feeling hot. Because of the activities which are carried out within the city region, that makes the ambient temperature warmer. So when you go out of the city, when you come into the city, if you can notice, the amount of quantity of heat which is coming in is same. But then the local ground situation has changed because of an activity, we call it as anthropogenic activity, that is man-made activity on the ground.
You made an interesting point, Nitya. One is that, because of UHI, the temperatures within an urban area may be elevated. Whereas if we go outside the city, and this is perceptible to all of us when we are driving down or we take a bus, etc., to go to a, holiday spot maybe for the weekend, we see a sudden drop. It may not be a great drop, but there's a perceptible drop in temperatures. Now, what are the differences between that area and an urban area, which kind of, increases the temperatures? Is it the concrete jungle? Is it the pollution? Is it the fact that, the wind or the breeze is trapped within, the constructed buildings within the city? What are the factors that make this happen?
If you look at it, the cities generally has a different surface morphology, starting from the impervious surfaces, which means the concrete jungle, as you said. And then there is a change in wind speed. When you go out of the city, you does not have much of obstacles on the surface. Whereas here within the city, you have tall buildings. Sometimes it blocks the wind flowing on a particular direction. In my past research, once we are studying an urban heat island effect in Hong Kong, it is interesting to share it here. The roads are well designed by Britishers over there. But then a very big hotel, which was built closer to the sea, and it has a beautiful sea view, but eventually blocked the wind, which is flowing on the direction. The result of that, an entire street gets zero wind speed. So imagine streets without wind speed, whatever heat which is generated on that street is going to stay on that street as excess heat. Whatever air conditioner being used, in fact, it is on one of a highly commercial activity street in Hong Kong, where all this big showrooms are there. So eventually they use high power air conditioner, which releases so much of excess heat. So this is a condition not limited to Hong Kong. It could be applicable to many places. Sometimes tall buildings are built, bridges were built. So it blocks the air in a particular direction. Then there is no, air. And then third is when you talk about pollution, yes, of course, this pollution is not a direct impact like the wind speed, but then it has an indirect impact. When you have pollution on top of it, the particles which is released on air, which also increases the impact of urban heat island. So it is not a separated effect, but then together, if you add it, it creates a lot of stress on the people on the ground. So basically the impervious surfaces, that is the concrete surfaces, and the wind speed and your pollution and the human activities, the quantum of vehicles which are going on road, or the building heat, the amount of heat released from the buildings in the form of refrigerators utilization or in the form of air conditioning utilization, all this contributes as an excess heat in an urban area and creates a difference compared to its rural one.
If a policymaker has to understand how to mitigate these factors, he or she will also have to understand what causes these urban microclimates? And if I may ask, if you can simply or in the most simplified manner, tell us what exactly constitutes urban microclimates and how is it different in different cities, depending on, like you pointed out, how buildings are constructed, how roads are constructed, how open spaces are designed, etc. Do they differ from city to city? And in that case, do policymakers have to then customize their approaches for each of these cities differently?
True. That's a very interesting and tricky question for me to answer as well. So let me explain it here. So microclimates are exist. Like, even in a small pocket, let's see, if you create a big park or even a small park, the condition over there is different from its surrounding, right? So there is a temperature variation, there is a humidity variation, there is a lot of variation compared to the larger area. So the microclimatic zone, the microclimatic spread actually increases when you have a lot of activities on these areas. Now, every city is being constructed in a different way. Some cities are constructed, some are actually evolved on its own when they have policies, when they have land availability, when they have infrastructure development. A lot of cities evolved on its own and then people try to mitigate it. But certain cities within our country is planned. So in those cases, the microclimatic conditions evolves. Let's say suddenly there is a new 1,000 houses are evolved in a particular complex. Then the climatic condition or the weather condition over that region changes. And that we call it as a microclimate. What is change in microclimate? The change in temperature value, change in other parameters are the indicators of microclimatic variation. Generally, people study this, through traversing. That is called people use instruments to go around these places and measure the temperature and other variations. But then with the advent of remote sensing after 1970s, people started using thermal remote sensing satellites. And they use it to map the surface temperature in lieu of air temperature. Technically, what we feel is a temperature value on the air. But, going around a particular city, if one person goes around a particular city, by the time you start and finish your survey, your value changes. The time period also changes. You may start at one end at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then by the time you reach other end, it might be 9 o'clock. So you cannot actually compare. In order to sort this out, people utilize a satellite-based observation where it gives you, at one shot, it gives you a temperature of the entire city. But the only difference here is it has limitation in measuring its air temperature. In lieu of that, it helps us to measure the surface temperature. So what is the difference between air and surface? The air is slightly, technically cooler, but the surface, if it is more concrete, it is warmer than its air. So the air temperature is a cumulative of a lot of things happening on that area, whereas surface temperature is largely controlled by the surface characteristics, the material which is made of. So this is what the satellite remote sensing has given. So people use this to identify which are the pockets which are having elevated temperature in cities. So as a planner, if anybody wants to look at, so far, the available tool is a satellite-based observation. As a first thing, one can look at, these are the pockets where we have elevated temperature. Then correlated with a ground-based observations using the thermometers where you can able to measure the heat on the ground. So once you have this, so basically these thermometers are thermocouple thermometers, which is slightly different from what we use for a temperature measurement on human body. This is based on a different principles. But then this kind of measurement, understanding the complexity on the ground in a detailed manner, help them to mitigate it. And as I said in my opinion editorial, more than understanding the heat value, it is also essential to understand the source of that heat. So because mitigation strategy depends on how effectively you identify its sources. So that's the primary way to start with, to do the mitigation factor for different cities, Sachin. Because there's one more thing I'd like to mention here. The kind of urban heat island impact is different from the cities which are having cooler climate and cities which are having warmer climate. Let's say most of the Indian cities, we look at the adverse effect of urban heat island, but at some parts of, let's say in Europe and in other colder regions, where this is seen as a blessing because it warms the air temperature. So your demand for heating is brought down. So you does not require much of electricity to heat your environment because largely the rooms are warm because of the extreme cold outside. Whereas in our case, this triggers and impacts in many ways. One of that is it also increases our electricity consumption.
Then it, won't it become like a vicious cycle, Nitya? Because the greater the air conditioning, the greater the heat that is dissipated into the atmosphere. And then it kind of affects the microclimate of the urban area. And then it, the demand for air conditioning goes up. And then it becomes like a vicious cycle.
True. This is exactly the problem. So what we feel is people who can afford, we always feel, how does it matter if a temperature rises from 39 to 41? If we are blessed with air conditioners, we can actually come into our house and then we can increase its efficiency. And then we can actually bring down that rate from 24 to 21. Or if you require turbo cooling, you can bring down to 16 degrees Celsius also. But what it actually does, it throws out the excess heat within the room to the environment, and eventually it comes back to you. And if you have nicely insulated your house walls and things like that, it's fine. But then sometimes a lot of communities or societies are adjacent to areas where people who provide service to these buildings, let's say in Delhi, a lot of poor areas has in slums associated with it. We call, let's say, urban slums or urban poor who are living associated to these areas. The excess heat which increases here will actually impact them more compared to you. While people use air conditioner to their comfort level, the ambient temperature in the environment is keep on increasing because you're actually throwing out whatever heat you have to the environment. And eventually it's a cycle. As you said, it will again increase the demand for cooling, and it will impact people whosoever goes out. Even if it goes out for walking thereafter, it's going to impact the individuals.
So it sounds like having as much a socio-economic issue as it is environmental and financial, in the sense that maybe the people in tall towers are able to afford air conditioning for all their rooms, but the people who are working in those buildings and who live in the nearby areas, for example, in the city of Mumbai, where slums and tall towers coexist right next to each other, this effect might be exacerbated than it was earlier. But in the larger context, I wanted to understand from you, because Indian cities typically have not been planned, especially after the 1960s and 70s, when the real estate boom started in many of the urban areas in Mumbai, in the country, including in Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, Chennai, etc. The growth has been haphazard. While we are seeing flooding and other direct consequences of that haphazard development, we are not perhaps as much educated or aware of in terms of the urban heat island effect. What is the impact? I just wanted to look at it from a broader perspective. What happened in the 1960s and 70s that is impacting our cities now? The real estate boom then, is it impacting us now? And is it now far from repair? Or do you think there are ways to mitigate the problems that we are facing these days?
Yeah. In fact, we are trying to repair it because, as you said, the cities were not planned properly, and it has developed for several reasons. At that time, maybe people justify there's a need for developing the cities because the world is moving towards cities. But then the alarming thing is the world is growing much faster towards cities. We may expect more and more cities to come, and even the existing cities expands in terms of its surface area. Now, the heat is a scenario which is most of the time ignored while people plan the cities, because you need to plan for flood, you need to plan for other disasters, let's say even earthquake, but heat is an indirect impact. And heat is considered as an important thing much, much later compared to other disasters within the country. Now, this heat can impact people directly or impact or indirectly. Let's say if there is a flood happens, the number of deaths which impacted due to flood is easily quantifiable. Whereas look at heat. Heat is a phenomenon where the number of heat deaths in the country, sometimes you can see more. There are some people who live along the coast says, oh, the so many deaths happened in the coast. But then the official record says there are less. That's because the way of understanding heat-related impacts, especially health impacts, is a lot of time considered as bacterial and viral infection, not the actual death scenario, which is based on heat. So since people have comorbidities, it is largely ignored as an heat impact. But then, yes, people know there's a heat impact. But then it's the direct death due to that is recorded less. So most of the time it is like people who died due to extreme heat on road. Once people perform postmortem, they should be able to record it as a concrete case based out of heat impact or heat stress, or you can call heat stroke. So this is a system which ignored heat as a as an impact. People always advise to take the mitigation factors like, by getting into shadows, drinking more water, keeping them hydrated and things like that. Where the system feels like, okay, heat is something which comes for a, period, and then people can manage it. And it is something which is beyond our capability to control it. But to be honest, it is something where people can minimize its impact. So that is feasible because of once you know the proper reasons for it, it is easy to mitigate it. So the cities are now trying to mitigate it, but there are a lot of suggestions given. Few cities in the country do have environmental management plan, and a lot of suggestions, recommendations given to states from the union government, especially on keeping the green cover percentage. But sometimes it is not happen as per the intention. Because the total, let's say the total percentage of green cover in a city has to be, let's say, 10% on overall, land area, for example. It depends on the city administrator to see whether the 10% exists in the form of urban trees or you have annexed the urban outskirt, which is formerly an agricultural land, into your area. And then say, now there are 10% green cover exists on the reality. So these are certain challenges which are exist. And people are struggling to increase the green cover, but a lot of technologies has come out how you can make your buildings green, or there are a lot of technologies which makes the materials that you use as eco-friendly and minimize impacts. So once we think of that detailed manner, how we can minimize it with the help of changing building material, how we can minimize it by creating more of water resources, how we can minimize it by planting more trees or increasing the green surface cover. That's an ideal way to start it. But largely, we are repairing our cities. And, even in the newly built cities, these things are not considered at large.
In your op-ed, Nitya, you've mentioned how Singapore and Hong Kong are at the forefront of researching anthropogenic heat emissions. And these areas are known, of course, for their intense summer heat. But they're developing sophisticated strategies to combat temperature increases, which can be directly attributed to human activity. Are there any parallel such possibilities in Indian cities? One. The second part of the question is, even if there is political will, what are the on-ground realities that we need to be aware of for these studies to take place? One. And two, for implementation to happen. For example, in Mumbai, we do have something. I live in Mumbai, you live in Bangalore. In Mumbai, we have something called the Mumbai Climate Action Plan, which was put in effect, or at least was discussed a couple of years ago. And the implementation of that would have started by now. But the mitigation measures will take a long time to take effect, given the damage that Mumbai has already gone through because of loss of green cover, because of pollution, because of urban construction, etc. So if we have to look at the Singapore and Hong Kong model in terms of just studying what they have done and then customizing it to the Indian scenario, what are the factors that we need to be aware of or to keep at the back of our mind to make this happen?
Yeah, Singapore and Hong Kong started Urban Heat Island research much earlier. And luckily, I was able to study under one of a leader who did this research, pioneering research in Hong Kong and in Singapore as well. With my professor is like Professor Sue Gribman and Professor Janet Nicole are people who have studied this Urban Heat Island for a very long time. Now, what is there in Hong Kong? Let's take only Hong Kong for the moment. And if you look at Hong Kong, the high rises are very much, and you have very limited ground space. But you see, most of the areas do have green cover. There are a lot of urban parks which are created, and it can be used as a recreational space. And two, it can also be used as mitigation place for the heat which is generated on that area. But then still, it is not effective and still people are suffering more due to the heat island impact. So what we tried to do in our research at that time, we tried to look at what are the scenario on a particular summer day with the help of high-resolution satellite imageries, with the help of helicopter bone thermography, which means the thermal cameras are fitted with helicopters to look at what is actually on the ground. And then we fix some smart sensors on the buildings to see how a building heat responds over a particular diurnal cycle, which means the entire time of a day. And then also we use ground roofs to grow, students can go across the city and measure temperature at different surfaces. It could be park, it could be vegetative surface, it could be an urban concrete surface and so on. In addition, the observatory from Hong Kong also used their vehicle to traverse across the city and to measure the air temperature, wind bulb temperature and other parameters related to thermal comfort. So when we do all this, we could able to understand the heat which is exist on the ground. And parallelly, we use satellite-based algorithms and also the ground-based information, let's say number of vehicles on roads and number of buildings and its extent in both in terms of horizontal and vertical elevations and expansions, and also the human beings, because human beings do contribute to a certain extent of heat emissions on the ground. So all this we mapped out and figured out, oh, this is the scenario which is happening on ground. When you're able to model it, you can able to mitigate it better. So we could able to know at what time in a particular road, what could be an excess heat which is released and what is the quantum and how it behaves in summer, how it behaves in winter, how it behaves in early morning, how it behaves in afternoon, how it behaves in peak hours. These are certain factors one has to measure. So that's probably the entire focus, and that was my PhD work. So in which we looked at what are the different scenarios, which part of the city has an issue. When it has an issue, dig it deeper and see what are the challenges, what are the scenario on ground, what actually contributes, whether the vehicle contributes to it or a building in that area contributes to it. So look at these things as an information. And once we know this, the mitigation strategies are something where everybody says, oh, you don't need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, like plant trees, add more water bodies and things like that. But then how you measure its impact? Once you know its root causes and when you're able to model and map precisely, after the mitigation measures also, you can able to understand its effectiveness of the mitigation strategy. So this is what the thing we have used in Hong Kong, Sachin.
One of the problems that we do have, and this is something that you've pointed out in your writing as well, is the absence of sensors that are capable of detecting land surface heat. If the fundamental measurement is not accurate, then are we able to approach policy solutions in a more pinpointed manner? In the absence of that, or in the absence of sensors, are there any alternatives, or do you think that the Indian governments, whether at the state level or at the national level, should be pushing for these technologies to be available for policymakers to make accurate diagnosis and therefore understand or rather prescribe policy formulations?
So there are two components here. The first component is the space-based asset. As I said in my opinion editorial, that the space-based assets that we have are capable of imaging like what we can see through our eyes. But then there are thermal cameras that requires to understand the heat which is emitted from the surface. Say, for example, if you take a picture of a cat with the help of normal camera, you could be able to identify its features, its colors, and so on. Whereas the same cat, if it is studied through the thermal camera, you can only see the temperature variations on the cat. Let's say if a cat tail is having a different temperature, if its ears has a different temperature, you can get it. When a background wall and a cat has similar temperature, the thermal camera could not able to distinguish it. So that's the beauty of thermal camera. So that is slightly different from the sensors that we see in our phones or in from satellites. But then India do have thermal sensors, but it is only measuring heat surfaces on the ocean, where we do not have something which can measure on the surface. Because surface measurement of heat requires finer resolution, which means finer detailing. It should be able to measure the heat emission of a rooftop, not the heat emission of a particular area in Bangalore. So when you look at on ocean, it is like that. The resolutions are something which is coarse, whereas on land, it requires the finer one. So in lieu of that, what we are using? Still people are studying urban heat island. People who have studied urban heat island in the past all use thermal sensors, which is based on Landsat or Sentinel. So the European Space Agency or the NASA one is the one which supplies this data for free of cost till date. So people utilize it to study it. My recommendation and my expectation is if we have a thermal sensor for our country, if it is made available for research, people would be more comfortable in using it. People would be more interested in using the Indian data sets and do it. This is one part. Second part is the flux measurement. As I said in my opinion editorial, the flux measurement. The flux measurement is an instrument basically which helps us to understand how much insulation comes in and how much radiation goes back to the atmosphere. This is something where the meteorological departments generally carries on. I really don't know whether we have such instruments which is widely placed in cities, or we may be having it in certain places for R&D purposes. So what is required in better understanding of this is keeping these sensors on different parts of the cities and see how much it is coming and how much it is radiated from the surface and what are the different components, because there are different components of heat, sensible heat, latent heat and ground heat and so on, all those things. So these are the instruments that we require to modernize our field-based observation. Otherwise, measuring air temperature, wind speed, humidity is not something where you can, it's like it gives you a basic parameter, but not the larger causative factors. And more importantly, a lot of times the place in which the, this measurement units are kept out, especially the air temperature, the wind speed and things like that, that we are seeing it, that we call the local stations, the weather stations, those are kept in a places which generally brings down slightly lower the scenarios in cat. You can see the temperature is 1 or 2 degrees cooler than the actual ones. So we need to have instruments like this to get a clear ground picture. I would like to share this, Sachin. In fact, NASA has certain programs. They were very keen to measure what's happening on the ground. It's not satellite that give you everything. You know, we were part of things where even we monitored few sensors which was given by NASA closer to the Hong Kong and China border. That is closer to Shenzhen, because that helps people to understand how much pollution is crossing the border and what is the scenario of heat on that particular area. So NASA measures it across the globe, but we need to have an indigenous system to understand this, and then the meteorological organization should use this extensively. If they use, they should make the data available for people to use it, researchers to use it, in order to make more localized effect research. It's not just one department to perform research. There needs to be a lot of multidisciplinary understanding on this. So the data has to be made open to all.
Yes, absolutely, Nitya. I mean, this requires a multidisciplinary approach, multi-department approach from all levels. And of course, including citizen participation, perhaps, because one is awareness. And second is, implementation of those mitigation measures ultimately will fall upon people like you and me. Thank you so much, Nitya, for joining me in this podcast episode. We run out of time, but what an illuminating episode this was. Thank you once again, and hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sachin. Have a good day. Bye.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.